Good morning. Welcome to the Monadnock Summer Lyceum. My name is David Robbins. I am the moderator for this morning's program. For many years, the Monadnock Summer Lyceum has been bringing outstanding, world-class speakers to the Monadnock region to serve as a catalyst to inform and engage and inspire an active citizenry on local, national, and global issues. The Monadnock Summer Lyceum is held at the historic Unitarian Universalist Church in downtown Peterborough, New Hampshire, at 11 o'clock on summer Sunday mornings. We invite our New Hampshire Public Radio audience to attend these programs and to meet our speakers at the reception following the program. After the talk, I will read questions from our live audience. Our speaker today is Gary Kowalski. Gary is an ordained minister and graduate of Harvard College and the Harvard Divinity School. He has served Unitarian Universalist churches in Vermont, Washington, Tennessee, Massachusetts, and New Mexico. Paleoanthropologist Stephen J. Gould said of him, "Gary offers wise thoughts as a fine naturalist and theologian who knows both humility before nature's grandeur and awe for human variety." He is past president of the Unitarian Universalist Animal Ministry, an award-winning speaker. He is an activist and an educator on behalf of justice for the Earth's voiceless. Please join me in welcoming Gary Kowalski.
Good morning. Namaste. Thank you, David. In 1963, a primatologist named Adrian Cortland witnessed something remarkable. He saw a chimpanzee coming out of the dense forest. This was at the end of day. It was sunset. The chimpanzee came into a clearing where he had a vista of the west, and he was carrying with him a papaya, a fruit that was his bedtime snack. Took the fruit, set it down on the ground beside him, and stood just looking at the sunset, gazing at the shifting colors of magenta and violet and rose, immobile, transfixed for 15 minutes, not moving a muscle. Finally, after a quarter of an hour, the sun dipped below the horizon, and the chimpanzee slowly turned around, walked back into the forest, forgetting his papaya, leaving it sitting on the ground. We'll never know exactly what was going through that animal's mind. You know, maybe thinking about old friends or days gone by, a moment of daydream or reverie, but I think it's safe to say that the animal had a mind. This animal was satisfying some hunger, some appetite that went beyond the need for physical sustenance, for food or drink, an inner appetite for wonder, for mystery, for quietude, for transcendence. And in this, the animal was satisfying an urge. Very, very old nature worship, a sense of awe and exultation for sun and moon and the glory of the earth and its living creatures. This is the primordial form of spirituality, and it seems to be universal. Years ago, I was training to be a hospice volunteer. The topic of the day was spirituality, and the instructor introduced it by asking us, "What makes your spirit soar?" There were about 20 people in the class. Some were Roman Catholics, some were Jews, some were Buddhists and Quakers, and some didn't have any religious affiliation. But everyone there spoke about some experience of renewal and rejuvenation in the natural world, standing underneath a redwood older than any human Bible, walking along the shore, listening to the pounding surf. The celebration of life and nature is very old, maybe older than humankind. in the high mountain caves of Switzerland and Germany, remains have been discovered of bears' bones that seem to have been arranged into symbolic patterns that some scholars interpret as a cult of animal veneration that existed among the Neanderthals, the early hominids who inhabited this region 70,000 years ago. It's a little controversial, but the excavation showed that the femurs, the thigh bones, had been placed inside the orifices of the skulls in ways that are hard to interpret as accidental, seem to be deliberate, and many of those same skulls had been painted a deep rusty red with hematite and buried in stone-lined pits, just as we know the Neanderthal buried their own dead, often accompanied by offerings of flowers to take them to the other side. Not conclusive, maybe, but suggestive, I think. 50,000 years later, our own Cro-Magnon ancestors in the south of France, in Lascaux, would decorate the walls and ceilings of their caverns with these magnificent images of ibex and stag and Arctic pony. When I was a kid, I learned that the cavemen were drawing the animals as a kind of sympathetic magic. Their renderings would capture the spirit of the animal and ensure success in the hunt. The funny thing is that now we know that the only animal that the Cro-Magnon hunted were the reindeer. The reindeer for them were what the buffalo were for the American Indian. They were kind of walking Walmart. They used everything from the hoof to the hair and the hide. But there are no images of reindeer in Lascaux. There are no images of the animals that they hunted. Instead, there are these depictions of the animals that they gazed upon and marveled at. The stallion and the bull and the bison and the lion and the rhinoceros, some of them enormous. There's a 17-foot-long bull there. These are the charismatic megafauna that seemed to excite the human imagination, and that still do. At least they did in the biblical book of Job, coming closer to historic times. Job's a very interesting book of the Bible because it is the longest epiphany in Scripture. An epiphany is a manifestation or showing forth of the divine. And Job, of course, asks for an audience with the Almighty. He wants some explanation for why the world's such a big mess. And God actually appears to Job out of a whirlwind and speaks. And this is interesting. God doesn't speak in the form of pronouncements or commands or proclamations. No, the divine speaks in the form of questions, asking Job, what do you really know about this mysterious world in which you find yourself living? Do you know, Job, who hung the North Star in the sky, or the Pleiades, or the Great Bear and his brother? Who said to the proud waves, thus far shalt thou come, and no farther? Have you been into the deeps of the sea? Do you know where the storehouses of snow and hail are kept? And Job is speechless in response. And then God takes Job on a kind of grand safari or eco-tour of the world's fabulous fauna, introducing him to a variety of species, first to creatures that I think of as representing the feminine, generative, nurturing qualities of life. Look, Job, here's the antelope ready to give birth. She goes into the hills to go into labor. How does she know where or when to go, when the time is right? Have you looked at the ostrich, how she lays her eggs in the warm sand, depending on the goodness and the warmth of Mother Earth to bring those chicks out of the shell? Or have you watched the mother eagle scouring the land for morsels and delicacies for her hatchlings? Have you thought about this stuff, Job? And then God introduces Job to another variety of animals, which I think of as representing the more masculine and wild side of life. Look, here's the crocodile with his armored flanks and his mighty tail. Can you pull him out of the water? Can you pull him out of the Jordan with your fish hook, Job? Or the hippopotami swimming there under the lotus? Can you hook him to your plow and plow your farmer's fields with a hippopotamus? The war horse, so heedless of danger, mighty in battle. What about that? And Job has no response. He had been expecting some explanation for this world, and he doesn't get an explanation. Instead, he gets a religious experience. He has a perceptual shift. He sits down on the ground. He covers himself with dust, and he says, "I repent. I despise myself." I always had a hard time figuring that out till I learned that Job wasn't having a bad self-esteem day here. He wasn't engaging in some bout of self-loathing. That phrase, "I despise myself," would better be translated, "I feel myself dissolving. I feel myself melting away. My little paltry ego is merging and becoming one with this panoramic universe of which I am just a tiny and momentary fragment." Children seem to share with pre-modern people this spiritual affinity with the natural world. So much so that the Harvard biologist E.O. Wilson says that we are born with a sense of biophilia, a love for everything that creeps and crawls, everything that wags and wiggles. Robert Vandecastle, who's a psychiatrist at the University of Virginia who studies dreams, says that we have this psychic menagerie. There's an unconscious zoo inside our heads, particularly when we're little children. And surprisingly, it's the tiny tots. It's the preschoolers, the 3 and 4 and 5-year-olds, who dream of animals almost every single night. And it's the most savage animals that they dream about. It's the snakes and the wolves and the bears and the lions and the tigers. And then Vandecastle finds that as we age and grow and mature, as we approach adolescence, those dream images are tamed and domesticated. We start to dream about dogs and cats and horses and cows. And then by the time we're all grown up and adults, we hardly dream about animals at all. It's as though that inward psychic connection, that kinship, is broken. But for some, it remains active and alive throughout their life. It can have a very visceral, palpable impact. This was true, for instance, of Clara Barton, a nurse, founder of the American Red Cross. She grew up just about an hour from here, south of the border in Massachusetts. Clara grew up on the farm in Oxford there, and it was the fall, October, time for slaughtering and dressing the meat for the winter. Well, Bossy the cow was brought into the farmyard, and the field hand was the one who had to do the dirty work. He had his mallet, his sledgehammer ready, and Clara was watching from the sidelines. The farmhand raised the heavy sledge in the air. He brought it down with a crash on the cow's skull, and just at that moment, Clara felt a tremendous blow to her own head. She blacked out. She lost consciousness. When she woke up again, she became a vegetarian. She never ate meat again. That's having an impact. Sometimes it's more subtle, but equally powerful. Jane Goodall says it all started for her as a kid, her love of animals. She'd visit her grandmother's farm every summer. Her task was to bring in the eggs from the hen house. She was just 4 years old. Apparently no one had explained the facts of life, because she got to wondering, where on a hen was there an opening big enough for an egg to come out? So she decided to investigate. You know, lifted up a hen there. Well, the hen didn't like that while it was laying. She worked it out that she would have to be there first. She crept into the hen house, hid into in a corner, very quietly, waited until one of the birds came in, sat itself down on its makeshift nest, and after a while lifted itself up on its legs, and Jane got a glimpse of the whole mystery. Well, very, very excited. She ran to tell her mother, but her mom didn't know where Jane had gone. She'd been disappeared for 4 hours. They'd called the police. But still, her mother, Van, wasn't angry, didn't scold. She didn't dampen Jane's scientific curiosity or her sense of wonder for the everyday miracles of life. Conrad Lorenz, who's equally famous as an animal scientist, says it started in his childhood growing up in Austria. He had a household full of pets, not only the usual dachshunds, but also a pet crocodile and a mole and various fish from the Danube River and even a lemur, which was in the bad habit of stealing and smoking cigarettes from the gas. But his favorite mascot was a little duckling that he got when he was just 6 years old. And he and his best friend Gretel would go out into the marshes of the Danube, and they would play with the ducks, and they would fully expect the hatchlings to follow them around just as they would their own feathered parents. Without understanding it at the time, he had stumbled across the discovery that would later make him famous and win him a Nobel Prize: the existence of imprinting in water birds. What he said later was that he didn't realize that not only were the ducks imprinting on him, he was also imprinting on the ducks, which was an impression that would last into his old age. Not all kids have these close relationships with animals. I grew up in town or on the outskirts of the city, wasn't really intimate with any animals, didn't really think much about them until I was all grown up. I was in my early 30s when I had a kind of awakening. This was when I heard the first reports about Coco and her kitten. Probably you know at least some of the story. It's been written up in National Geographic and so forth. I think I first heard it on National Public Radio. Coco is a female lowland gorilla. At the time, she was living out at the Gorilla Foundation in Woodside, California, with her trainer, Dr. Francine Penny Patterson, which is how she had mastered about 500 words in American Sign Language. And that was how she told Penny that she wanted a cat for her birthday, which she signed by pulling her fingers across her cheeks like whiskers. She'd apparently gotten this idea from Puss in Boots, which was one of her favorite picture books. So a little cat was presented to Coco, an orphan cat that had been cross-fostered in the first few months of life, suckled by a terrier, actually. And this new cross-species friendship took hold. Coco named the little cat All Ball. She carried around, tucked against her inner thigh, the way mother gorillas carry their own babies. They played chase and tickle, and Coco was very surprised to learn that cats bite. She made her typical signs of disapproval, dirty cat, toilet, and so forth. But they were quickly reconciled. And then somehow one night, All Ball escaped from the Gorilla Foundation, got into the street, was hit by a car and killed. When Coco was informed of this, at first it appeared that she didn't understand. There was no affect. She was numb, in a state of shock, disbelief, denial. But then very quickly she became visibly upset and continued to be agitated for some weeks afterward whenever the subject of cats came up. Well, the startling thing about this report is that one of the people who worked with Coco was able to probe a little more deeply to find out just what she understood about this incident. So Coco was asked the question, why do gorillas die? To which she made the signs trouble and old. And then Coco was asked, where do gorillas go when they die? To which she responded with the signs for comfortable hole, like a hole in the ground, and then the sign for goodbye, blowing a kiss, touching your lips to your fingers with a gesture of farewell. Finally, Coco was asked, how do gorillas feel when they die? Are they happy? Are they sad? Are they afraid? Coco responded by putting her head on her hand in the sign for sleep. This had such a big impact on me, I think, because My own grandfather had passed away just a few weeks before. And my dad died when I was quite young, so my grandfather was an important person in my life, and I was struggling with his loss. And at this point, I'd already been to divinity school. I was an ordained minister. I was serving my first church out on the West Coast. I was supposed to be a pastor, providing guidance to other people who were looking for, you know, comfort in time of adversity. But the truth was, I didn't have a lot of answers myself, because this question of where we find meaning and hope and strength in the face of death and loss, that's not the kind of question where you find the answer in a book or learn it in school. You have to work through it yourself. And Coco's story somehow just touched me in an incredibly healing way. It was as though my heart opened up. And I understood that my own personal, private load of grief and pain that I was carrying around wasn't so private after all. That this story wasn't just mine, and it certainly wasn't about me. That I was part of this much larger narrative, a narrative of birth and death and rebirth and beginnings and endings that had been going on time out of mind. And although I'd lost a dear member of my own family, it was as though I felt myself welcomed into a much larger family, a family that included Coco and All Ball and all who walk in love and joy and travail beneath this sun. And it set me thinking, because I asked, you know, if Coco's answers to the question of where do we go when we die, if her answers are as good as yours or mine, what else had I been missing about other living creatures? Were there other species who were aware of death? Were other creatures possessed of a moral sense, an ethical compass, a sense of right and wrong? I started to wonder, why do animals dance? Why do they play? Do they have an aesthetic sense? Do they appreciate art or music like we do? And of course, the answers that emerged, which were outlined in my first book, The Souls of Animals, were that animals, other species, are much more similar to ourselves than we usually understand. And this is a conclusion that's completely supported by science. Cynthia Moss, for example, has studied elephants in the wild in Africa for decades, and she makes it clear that, you know, it's not just gorillas or people who are aware of death. If an elephant is out there and encounters the corpse or carcass of one of their own kind who's died, the elephant will inevitably stop, even if it's a bleached bare skeleton. They'll pick up the bones in their trunk and carry them hither and yon, apparently, you know, trying to find a proper resting place for the remains. They'll feel the skeleton, particularly the skull. They'll use their trunk, which is just marvelously sensitive. There are about 200,000 separate muscles in that elephant's trunk. They'll feel the contours of the head, trying to recognize the individual who's died. She talks about one family that she studied in Kenya. This was a family of females. The males go off and do their own thing, and the family had wandered outside the sanctuary, the game preserve where they lived, and they were attacked by hunters. And one of their number, a teenager, an adolescent named Tina, who was about 15 years old, was shot in the chest by the hunters. Well, it was a mortal wound. The blood was pouring from her body. At this point, her mother, Teresia, and Trista, her aunt, raced to the young one's side, leaning inward with their weight to support Tina, to try to keep her upright, to walk her back home to safety. But that didn't work. She was too badly hurt. She collapsed to the ground, at which point another member of the family, Tallulah, started going into the grass, gathering herbs, good things to eat, putting it into Tina's mouth, trying to bring strength and nourishment. Finally, Tina died. But even then, the family didn't just abandon the body. They stayed there all night long, going into the surrounding brush, gathering twigs, branches, dirt, earth, vegetation, covering the body in a kind of elephant funeral, remaining all night long until the sun rose over the eastern horizon, and then headed back to the Amboseli Reserve. And Tina's mother, Teresia, was the very last to go. Now, I've been a clergyman for a number of years, and I've presided at many graveside services where I have seen similar behavior. You know, the body's in the earth, all the prayers have been said, the benediction has been uttered, but the family doesn't want to leave. They just linger there because they're not ready for that last goodbye. And I don't think it's anthropomorphizing or projecting human traits onto animals to suppose that these elephants might have been experiencing the same kind of outrage and shock and anger and disbelief, pain that we might feel if one of our own children had been shot and killed. Now, that's not anthropomorphizing. At least that's what Conrad Lorenz said. This isn't a case of projecting human traits onto animals. This is recognizing animal traits in ourselves, in human beings. As I mentioned, Lorenz spent most of his career studying birds, jackdaws and geese, mostly species that mate for life. The strength and resilience of those bonds was demonstrated in a story where a horseman was on a plane. He was out riding, and in the far distance, he could see two birds who were walking, one in front of the other, about 50 paces in the lead. And periodically, the bird that was in the lead would take off into the air, fly around in circles, honking loudly, plaintively, and then land again in the forward position, and the two would continue walking, and this pattern would repeat itself until finally the horseman got close enough so that he could see what was going on. It was a pair of geese, a pair bond. The female was in the back. She'd broken her wing. They were on their migration to the south, to the Magellanic Islands, thousands of miles away. But even in that dire emergency, the male refused to abandon his partner. This was an attachment that was good through thick and thin till death do them part. Now, calling that kind of commitment love, Lorenz said, is not anthropomorphizing. No, it's because we are animals. You and I are animals. We're social creatures like geese, like kittens, like gorillas, like elephants. That's why we can experience these feelings of love and loyalty and fidelity, of friendship, why we're threatened when those relationships seem to be severed. We feel jealousy or envy. And when the relationships are broken, we go into grief and mourning and bereavement. That's part of our animal nature. That's a conclusion that was fully shared by Charles Darwin, the great grandfather of all modern biology, in his book, The Descent of Man. Darwin said that whatever difference in emotional capacity exists between Homo sapiens and other species, it's a difference of degree, not a difference of kind. And that was based, of course, on his theory that we share millions of years of history in common, as well as a common ancestor. Now, to make concrete what that means to have a common ancestor, let's do a thought experiment here for just a moment. We're in a church. There are a couple of aisles running down the side. Imagine that we had a human chain running down one of these aisles to the right, a chain composed of women, a daughter, a mother, and her mother. And if they were still living, we could add a great-grandmother and a great-great. So we have a matrilineal link. We could imagine it extending all the way down the aisle and out the door and into the distance. A human chain through time as well as through space, handing down the human genome. And now imagine that in the left-hand aisle of the sanctuary here, we have another line similarly composed. But this line is composed of chimpanzees. Again, a daughter, a mother, a grandmother, great-grandmother running into the distance. Now, before Darwin's time, it was thought that those two lines would be like railroad tracks. They would run parallel and never meet. But now we know that that's not the case. Follow those lines into the distance, and as you get far away, they begin to come closer and eventually to merge. It would be a ways away, but not that far, about as far as I drove over from Vermont to New Hampshire to speak here this morning. Those two lines would no longer be separate lines. They would come to a convergence point, and standing at the convergence point, there would be one individual. In her right hand, she would be holding the hand of one daughter. In her left, she would be holding the hand of another daughter. The beginning of the human line and the line of the pantroglodytes, so the chimps and bonobos. And she was a real person. We don't have to call her Eve, but she lived in Africa about 5 to 7 million years ago. What happened, though, is that sometime in the much more recent past, a division started to open between those two lines, and the division widened into a chasm, so that those on grandmother's right hand were considered to be of an entirely different order of being than those on the left. Those on the right hand, in the language of ethicists and moral philosophers, were considered to be ends in themselves, beings with inherent value and dignity and worth. Those on the left-hand side were considered to be means to an end. They existed solely to serve human purposes. Those on the right-hand side had biographies. Those on the left merely had biologies. Those on the right-hand side were endowed with inalienable human rights, life, liberty, the pursuit of happiness, and so forth. Those on grandmother's left-hand side had no legal standing and no rights. Those on grandmother's right were considered to be rational free agents. Those on the left, governed by blind, brute, unthinking instinct. Among the most precious human rights that we claimed was the right to own and possess property. But those on grandmother's left hand were considered to be commodities, property, possessions, to be sold and traded and exchanged. Those on grandmother's right hand had immortal souls. They were created in the image of God. Those on the left side were soulless and perhaps simply automatons. And the consequences of this division have been terrible. They've been terrible for our own species. We've been alienated from nature, from the sources of our own wisdom and strength, but they've been catastrophic for the natural world, as Homo sapiens has come to dominate this planet in ways that have begun to suck out its very life energy. All life, of course, comes from the sun. The plants take that sunlight and they turn it into sugars and carbohydrates and proteins, and they use some of those building blocks for their own maintenance and reproduction. And what is left over is called the net primary production. The net primary production is what remains for all the millions of species of animals that inhabit the earth. At this point in 2013, one of those species is using roughly 40% of the planet's net primary production, leaving 60% for the millions of others who walk the globe's surface. And this is one of the reasons we're in an extinction crisis. We're in the middle of a die-off that's bigger than anything since the time of the dinosaurs. Extinction levels 100 times the normal background rate. We've devastated and denuded vast areas of the richest habitat. There's been a geographic region the size of France, clear cut out of the heart of the Amazon, mostly to to graze cattle to provide cheap beef for the fast food joints and tables of Europe and America. There are vast dead zones in our oceans, areas that have been polluted by runoff and overfished to the point of lifelessness. About a year ago, my wife and I were visiting the aquarium down in Boston. If you've been there, you know there's a nice exhibit of African penguins when you go in. The curator told us these penguins, they're going to be gone in the wild in less than a dozen years because their food chain has collapsed. The fish that they depend on to survive are no longer there. Now, our environmental crisis is in large part a spiritual crisis. It's not going to have a technological fix, not an engineering fix. It demands a change of heart and mind and perspective and attitude. We need to remember that life is not a commodity. Life is a community. And we are not the overlords or masters of creation. We are not the earth's proprietors or owners. We're its stewards and trustees. We're just one strand in that intricate tapestry. What's needed now is for all of us to open ourselves in compassion to the other life forms of the planet. And fortunately, compassion is a trait that we seem to have with other primates and with the great apes. Almost 50 years ago, back in 1964, Jules Mosserman reported on some research that he did in the American Journal of Psychiatry. This was a study of altruism in rhesus monkeys, also called macaques. And what they did was they took a monkey and put it in an immobilizing chair, a restraining device, which is kind of sad when you think about it. And then they taught the monkey to pull a chain in coordination with a flashing light, and this was how the animal got its food, received its daily ration. And the monkeys quickly mastered this. They're bright, intelligent animals. And then the second part of the experiment was introduced. Another animal behind a one-way mirror, also in a restraining chair. And now every time the first animal pulled the chain to get his food, the other animal would receive a painful electric shock. This was supposed to be an experiment that would measure the difference that kinship might make in the display of altruism. Would it matter if the monkey in the other chair were a brother or a sister or a cousin or some more distant relation? Well, it turned out that almost all the animals involved were dissidents. They were resistors. They were conscientious objectors. They would not go along with the game. One of the animals sat in that restraining chair for 12 days, almost 2 weeks, without a bite to eat, rather than pulling the chain and deliberately inflicting torment on its neighbor. And it turned out it didn't make any difference at all if they were genetically related. The only predictive variable in determining what the first monkey might do was whether he or she had also sat in that other chair, if they knew what it meant to be on the receiving end of cruelty or kindness. This is compassion. The monkeys have it. And they also have a sense of justice and equity. You take two capuchin monkeys and teach them some simple task. You give the first one as a reward a bland slice of cucumber, and you give the second one a tasty grape. What happens? First monkey goes on strike. He's not going to work under those conditions that he perceives to be unfair, that violate his sense of right and wrong. If even monkeys have a sense of fairness, how can we claim that the fruits of justice and mercy belong solely to our kind? Compassion extends across the species line. A few years ago in Chicago, there was an incident that took place in the Brookfield Zoo. Little boy, 4 or 5 years old, was interested in the gorillas. No one was watching him closely. He managed to climb up the wall, fall over into their enclosure, and bump his head on the pavement. Well, gorillas are territorial. The males didn't like this other male great ape invading their space and started to make some threatening gestures, at which point another of the females, who was named Binti Wa, which in Swahili means daughter of sunlight, who was a nursing mother carrying her own 18-month-old on her back, she saw this other relation lying there helpless on the ground, raced over to the little boy, picked him up gently in her arms, carried him to the exit, waiting for the docents and the aid cars to arrive. Extending our circle of kinship and compassion is a teaching that's found in many of the great world religious traditions. One of my favorite stories is from India, from the Hindu epic, the Mahabharata, which is about 2,500 years old. It's a story of a spiritual journey. The hero's named Yudhishthira, and he's on a pilgrimage. He's in search of immortality and eternal life and bliss. Yudhishthira has come to the end of his journey. This is the very finale of this very long book. He's managed to reach the summit of the very highest peaks of the Himalayas, and all his brothers and traveling companions have fallen by the wayside. They've been weighed down by their karmic sins and so forth. But Yudhishthira is pure and blameless and upright, and he makes it to the very tippy top. And there Indra, the king of the gods, is waiting for him with a golden chariot to take him to heaven. And Indra says, "Well done, Yudhishthira. You've made it all the way. Get in, let's go. But I notice, Yudhishthira, you have a dog with you, and I have to tell you, we have a rule. There's no dogs in heaven. You're going to have to leave your traveling companion behind." At which point, Yudhishthira protests, and he says, "Indra, this dog has been with me through my whole journey. He's been faithful, loyal, true. I can't abandon this animal now. That would be contrary to the teachings of compassion, and compassion is at the heart of the Vedas, our oldest and holiest scriptures." Indra says, "Well, a dog is not worthy of eternity, and a rule is a rule." Now, in an act of supreme self-denial and self-sacrifice, Yudhishthira says, "Well, if that's the case, I guess I'm sticking with my dog. I'll just forgo my chance at heaven, and we'll both stay outside the gates of bliss." And of course, this had just been a trial, a test, an ordeal. The dog, whose name is Savana, was actually a god. And the god is translated into the upper firmament, into the celestial realms, and becomes the dog star, the brightest object in the night sky. And so both man and mutt enter paradise together. And it's just a myth, it's just a legend, but I think there is a lesson for us there, that it's in these relationships of self-giving, of charity and generosity, of fidelity, of unconditional love and care and acceptance, that we find a little foretaste of heaven. And the story of Savana and the dog Star brings us to where we started, with the image of the chimpanzee looking at the night sky and the setting sun. Can we recognize that the chimpanzee wasn't just responding to some radiance out there, that the radiance was also inside, that there was a light in that animal that we also share, a light that lives in all sentient beings? The unity of life is an immemorial teaching celebrated in all the world's traditions. "Ask now the beasts, and they shall teach thee," we read in the Bible. "The fowls of the air, they shall teach thee. Speak to the earth, and it shall teach thee, or the fishes of the earth shall declare unto thee." Says the Quran, the holy book of the Muslims, "There is not an animal on earth, nor a creature flying on two wings, but they are peoples like unto you." "The greatness of a nation and its moral progress," observed the great Hindu teacher Mohandas Gandhi, "can be measured by the way its animals are treated." In recovering the primordial knowledge that all life is sacred, we may not only manage to save our world, but also save our own souls in learning how to coexist peacefully with other life upon this planet we might also find peace within. Thank you all for listening. Thank you again to the Unitarian Church of Peterborough for hosting this Monadnock Lyceum, and a special thanks to Anna Matera for that fantastic music this morning.